This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, vampires, incubi, and goblin kings, the demon lover in myth and speculative fiction.
So this week was actually inspired by a Tumblr post, of all things.
Yes, Madeleine sent me a link to it, possibly because she knows my love of all things labyrinth related. But also, it was a really interesting opinion and counter-opinion on what exactly the Goblin King Jareth actually represents in Labyrinth.
And yeah.
Obviously, we're not going to summarise the post now, but maybe I'll link to it and people can go and read it if they want to themselves. But it did start us thinking about this idea of, like, the Dark Prince, the demon lover in speculative fiction, and the fact that it has its origins in really ancient mythology. So we thought, since we haven't really looked at it, we're going to delve into it today.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the whole demon lover, I think, is something that is enough of a cultural phenomenon that everyone has actually encountered it in some shape or another. Before we kind of delve really into the conversation, we should probably actually give our definition. You know, what is the meaning of demon?
Yes. Okay, well, this is where I get to be a bit of an etymology nerd. If you read the episode title, you'll notice that I've spelt demon in the Greek form, which means...
Daemon!
which means a spirit of intellect or emotion or a passion, rather than the more Christian demon, which is to do with infernal influences and fallen angels.
Hooray!
So, yeah, I suppose a more accurate is the Greek demon lover, in the sense of a being that is not really human, but inspires some of the most primal human passions, perhaps.
Yeah. And, I mean, I can sort of get into a lot of discourse here of picking things and things like that. But I will make a small little observation, which is that it's very interesting to me that the sort of the Greek demon, with the A-E, was representative of this kind of this intellect. There's certainly a sense of, you know, temptation coming in there as well a little bit. Not necessarily a moral kind of character in any shape or form, but a figure of knowledge and understanding and something much deeper, and, you know, about sort of exploring things. And I do find it amusing that this creature became the bad guy of Christian mythos, in that, no, you shall not question, no, you shall not explore these deeper emotions or intelligence or anything like that, because obviously that's kind of the enemy of, that was the enemy of the medieval church, really.
It's quite interesting when you think about it. You can kind of see how that mindset would have come about, simply by having someone who is quite educated in, say, Greek and Latin, who talks about this almost outside influence, you know, these urges, the urge to obviously procreate, but also to just have sex for pleasure and to, and to maybe passionately love someone in a way that is very tied up with you know, sexual congress and pair bonding, in the sense that these were all things that were supposed to be denied, because we'll get into that in a moment, but since they were supposed to be denied, this sort of separating that part of yourself and saying, oh, no, 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 it's a demonic influence, in the sense of it is this spirit of intellect and emotion and passion, which is from outside yourself. And then perhaps the slightly less educated misunderstood it as, oh, no, there are these real little creatures that go around and whisper in your ears telling you you want these things and you must resist them. So, yeah, a little aside there, but I think that may well be how some of that came about, and it's... as with a lot of these things, they're sort of metaphorical and philosophical ideas and thought experiments, which people then took very literally. So there's that. But yeah, largely when talking about a demon lover, we are largely going to be talking about sex. Not exclusively, but that is largely what the entire concept kind of represents and the way it's evolved over the centuries in different cultures and different time periods reflects the mores and morals and thoughts of those times.
Yeah, absolutely.
The thing to remember is that historically and culturally, sex has been perceived in very different ways. This perception has also depended entirely on gender and the sexuality of the individual. And it really also depends where you are in the world. It's something, as Madeline has said, that most cultures do have like a demon lover mythos, but it's very noticeable in cultures that don't have prescriptions on women having sexual agency and on, you know, gay people having sexual agency, the bent of those demon lover tales is very different. They're not cautionary tales about sex and or not having sex, rather, or about, you know, these creatures that prey on you. They're actually kind of a be aware that by making this your master, you're going to do some bad stuff. So the focus is very different. As I said, we'll get into that a bit more in a moment, but. Yeah, there's quite a bit to unpack there, but I suppose the problem is let's blame the Victorians again. It's partly the Victorians.
When in doubt.
It's the idea. I mean, I suppose because I've done so much research on medieval history, certainly Western medieval history, I get a bit frustrated when people go, oh, well, that's a medieval attitude towards sex. And I'm like, it's really not a medieval attitude towards sex. The medieval attitude towards sex was that women were primal sexual beasts that needed to get a certain amount of it, otherwise they weren't quite peculiar. there is a reason why, you know, it was perfectly acceptable for a wife to complain that her husband was not delivering, you know? There is even a reason why, you know, women who felt they were unsatisfied, it was known that women might then go and have sex with other women, you know, in order to achieve the objective, as it were.
It was, sorry, small caveat. Jules sent me this amazing Twitter thread a few weeks ago. Most bizarre story from a medieval chronicle, which basically involved a woman going to the king and sort of saying, I am pregnant, but I've not lain with a man.
For years.
Can you, with your king's truth, tell me who the father of this child is? And the king's like, have you lain with another woman? Don't lie now. She's like, well, yes. And he's like, I see. In which case, it's her husband's child, for she passed stuff on to you.
Yeah, and I think in the original version of that tale, it's actually a case of, well, yes, you know, her husband didn't satisfy her, so after he had sex with her, she came and had sex with me. And it's a case of, oh, well, she obviously didn't wash first then, because apparently she really did pass something, pass the sperm on. And I'm like, okay, that's bizarre, but it is actually possible. But, you know, and obviously it's kind of a wild ride, and this is a... Then there's the typical sort of monk propaganda where, you know, someone gets dropped out of the heavens and... And it was some saint or angel that was passing by, and he'd been caught by a horde of demons, but the king's truth had released him and dropped him at the king's feet.
Yeah, that was it, yeah.
That's where...
I love that the most shocking part of the whole story isn't that she had sex with a woman. That was just a sub-note, and it was like, okay, and then someone falls from the sky.
Yeah, I mean, that was really kind of... That was really the funny bit was kind of like, well, yeah, obviously her husband didn't satisfy her. Of course she went to another woman. She really probably should have had a wash first, kind of thing. Try to get back on track. I mean, it's a great story. The idea that once again, the medieval attitude was that there weren't same-sex couples when absolutely there were, and that there weren't that women didn't have sexual agency. Well, you know, women weren't permitted the freedom of sexual agency, but they were absolutely expected to want it and to enjoy it. The number of monks I have now read who talk about women's voracious appetites and the fact that, you know, once a man's satisfied, a woman's still can just keep going and going. And the almost hysterical tenor of the fact that women can have more than one orgasm. Sort of like, what are we supposed to do? How are we supposed to satisfy these women? Nothing's nothing will keep them quiet. It's hilarious. So yeah, you could go off on a real tangent, but yeah, the medieval attitude there was that women, you know, shouldn't necessarily give in to their base animal instincts, but you must expect them to want to do those things because obviously they're the prime creative force.
Yeah.
On the other hand, with men, it's kind of like, well, they're expected to be more reasonable and not need it as much. Mm. But on the other hand, many, many monks and abbots and bishops and what have you, even popes, I think, have said, well, we do need to make prostitutes available. So possibly recognising that if they don't have some sort of outlet, they'll turn to violence instead.
Yes.
Which, again, is something that I've read in various chronicles. So once again, we're looking at history with a Victorian veneer overlaid. And it really was sort of the Victorian era where we got the whole, well, women aren't supposed to enjoy sex. They're not supposed to want it. And it's something that we then took and it really got crystallised and it overlaid everything, you know, all the way up through the Edwardian era and down into sort of the 60s, you know, the ideal homemaker type territory. As in, it's something you would do with a man because you really loved him, but you wouldn't really enjoy it that much. So your pleasure comes from having children kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which we know is all bollocks. It's all bunkum. But it's very interesting, sorry to get back on the topic, that in the more repressive periods of history, certainly from a Western perspective, that the whole demon lover side of fiction and the mythology has sort of taken an upswing. And yeah. I haven't done this, but I reckon you could quite easily chart a historical graph and then chart, you know, the upswings, the changes, the graduations of evolution of the demon lover, and you would probably get two lines that are very, very similar.
Yeah. Yeah, I can very well believe that. The demon lover appears during those times of repression, but the nature of the demon lover also will change in accordance to the general moral attitude at the time.
Absolutely. So it's not that there isn't, there aren't or weren't stories of incubi or what have you. Although, you know, obviously in the West, everything was sort of like fairies. So everything was from Elfheim. So they didn't necessarily distinguish between ghosts, fairies, vampires, etc. They were all kind of like these sort of spirit type things. And demons obviously were coming in as well. The idea was that you know, being a lustful individual or too much of a lustful individual would lay you open to these sort of influences. What they were really cautioning against was not so much sex or the enjoyment of it, no matter what your gender or you know what your preference was. It was adultery largely. It is worth, while we're talking about medieval attitudes, you could be burnt at the stake for being an adulteress.
Yeah.
So I don't think it happened very often, but theoretically that was there. If you tried to kill your husband, they almost always burnt you at the stake.
Weirdly enough.
They like to discourage that sort of thing.
But that, it's also funny as well because the whole demon lover thing, it does sort of take, again, it has those different flavours. Like, I would argue that the Lenanxi, who was kind of like a muse sort of creature in Irish mythology, who would sort of shorten your lifespan, and there was definitely a sexual element is there, but basically provided artists with inspiration and things like that. I would argue that she is a demon lover.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. It's really that there is almost an inseparable parallel there between creating something,
yeah,
and sex,
yeah,
for obvious reasons. Yeah. So even if what you're creating is literature or poetry or music or art, mm, then you, once again, you're a creative force, and it's feeding on that.
Yeah, definitely.
So basically, what we're saying is you need to start from the perspective of, depending on what era you are in, different mores and morals and values applied, different attitudes to sex applied, and, you know, different attitudes towards being homosexual or bisexual or pansexual even applied, because nobody really identified like that. It was just a case of, no, we desire this person.
Yeah.
I happen to desire more people who are shaped like this than people who are shaped like that, etc.
Yes. Absolutely. Small little caveat. Just as a general reminder, whenever you think about homosexuality, particularly in the sort of ye olden times, the word sodomy comes up a lot.
Yes.
Just to emphasise, sodomy is any act of, you know, sex which isn't about impregnation. So technically, having sex with a condom would be sodomy.
Yep. Masturbation.
Masturbation is sodomy. Oral pleasures and all that jazz, it's all sodomy.
Yes.
So I just thought I'd put that in there because I think that there's this very common thing which is like, ah, oh, you know, they're going around killing sodomites. Meaning, oh, they're going around killing gay people. No. It was, I think, definitely there were a lot of, you know, homosexual individuals who did fall prey to that, but it's not as simple as that. And when you are looking back at texts and looking back at history, you do need to be very careful that you understand the language and its meaning so that you don't misinterpret what you're actually looking at.
Yeah, the other thing to think about is the medieval language of law, which was very, very different to what we would use now and, you know, hadn't fully developed. So when you're looking at accounts of people who are being punished for sodomy, and, you know, the attitude was generally a case of, okay, well, if you have to do it, that's fine, but we don't want to see it. And if we do end up seeing it, you're going to get fined, and we'll gradually increase the fine if you keep doing it.
Yeah.
In some respects, that's kind of reasonable, because we wouldn't be happy with two people just randomly having sex by the side of the road in full view of everyone now. So
No. That's
not entirely off the wall there. That's kind of a bit irrelevant. When you're looking at... There's only a couple of cases I can think of where it was a man who'd had sex with a boy who had who was genuinely put to death. And in all of those cases, while they don't distinguish the language, they just use the word sodomy because it means a type of sex that isn't going to result in impregnation, because, you know, man having sex with a boy is not going to result in a baby.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter how you do it. that the reason they went straight from, okay, you did this, to we're going to burn you to death, and that was the punishment, was simply because it was rape. But they didn't have a word for rape as a pertained to a boy.
Yeah.
So this was a case of, this was a child molester, and the attitude towards child molesters was, oh God, that's so wrong, we're going to just kill you.
Yeah.
So it was, I'm not saying that there was no persecution, but there was a lot less of it than people think.
Yeah. And again, I mean, other thing you have to remember is that history is wide, different cultures had different things, and also that there would be waves over time, waves within a small community, even over like just a few decades, where things were more tolerated and then when things weren't. Sometimes who was on the throne could make a big difference.
Yes.
Significant difference. But yeah, it was also, you have to bear in mind that during certain times during history, when different religions were perhaps at higher points of power or higher points of influence, opinions did change, but it is not a static, in the past they were all like this. It doesn't work like that at all. And yeah, you really do have to consider language in that might not always have been, well, they killed them because they were homosexual. There might have been a lot of other things going on at the same time. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So the demon lover, you do have to consider, you do have to consider all the language as well when you are looking at the demon lover and their prevalence. And I'm also going to put forward that there is a really good reason why the demon lover is just all over Victorian fiction.
Yeah. Before we go on to that bit, because obviously that's going to be a really good big chunk, yeah, it's just worth looking at a couple of examples of like the demon lover as pertains to other cultures. So while we have a largely, and have for some time, a largely monogamous type culture, mm-hmm, where it's at least one at a time, even if it's not one for an entire life.
Yeah.
If you take people like the Maori, as they were traditionally, it was nobody's business who a woman had sex with. And having sex with somebody did not mean you were married to them.
Yeah.
And even within the marriage, it's not that they didn't mate, but they basically, a Maori woman would only be considered married if she took a man into the longhouse and acknowledged him as her husband,
right,
and vice versa. But who she slept with was kind of like, that was her business and nobody else's, really. And this was, if you think about it, that's a way of ensuring that, you know, since the idea is obviously to produce children, if you're stuck with a man who cannot produce children for any reason, then you've got a better chance of the sperm hitting the goal if you try with lots of different people, basically.
Thank you for that very mechanical explanation.
You're welcome. But I mean, it's obvious, isn't it?
Yeah.
To us now. But it wasn't necessarily obvious when people weren't really sure how the baby making went about. And as a species, we have concealed ovulation. You know, with obviously animals, they have specific oestrus seasons when they give off specific smells full of pheromones that attract the males and make them think, oh, it's mating time. We don't tend to do that. Which means, you know, we're fertile the entire year round. And it's concealed, you know, as I said, it's concealed ovulation. We don't have a sort of, okay, this is it, this is peak breeding time, get in there, boys, kind of thing, yeah, going on. Which is why, as a culture, and as sort of, there's a fair bit of anthropological evidence that early tribes and early societies and, you know, our cave-dwelling ancestors didn't practice this strict monogamous type relationship, but sort of you formed a home with somebody who was going to be stable as a mate, but they were kind of like your helpmeet, and yes, you would have sex with them, but you'd also have sex with other people as well,
yeah,
because it spread out the chance of actually getting pregnant.
Yeah,
so there you go. So you'd have that with sort of the Maori. It's very interesting that their version of a demon lover story is someone who comes in and takes your attention and seduces you away from your family. And it's not so much that you're having sex with them, it's the sense that they are drawing you away from the wide tribe, because everyone in the tribe is your family.
Yeah.
So this is someone who you obsess over to the point where you then stop looking after yourself and eating and sleeping and drinking. You stop paying attention and contributing to your tribe. So I just think that's a really interesting take on the whole demon lover thing.
Yeah, that is really, really cool and very interesting, yeah.
There is a group sort of that on the border of China, I think, where, again, it is very similar. You form family units, and then when the daughter is of age, they, you know, she starts entertaining people as she chooses. And nobody asks any questions about it. And, you know, virginity is not really considered a thing. It's just kind of like a whatever kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's not a big prize or anything. And she may not actually choose to form a unit with somebody and start a new family until she's already pregnant. And again, this whole demon lover type thing is a beautiful creature who appears in the night and seduces you away from the family unit.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it's also with the Lenanshi that I mentioned before, the whole concept of the Lenanxi is that she's almost sort of seducing you away from taking care of yourself. In that it's this idea of this completely obsessive behaviour which comes to sort of art, pouring every single part into your work.
Yeah.
And
any writer who has pulled an all-nighter editing in order to get something to a publisher on deadline knows that feeling. Now imagine doing that for years of your life. You wouldn't live very long.
Yeah, and the idea is that with the Lenanxi is that you produce amazing stuff, but you don't live long. And this isn't, again, when you looked at the lives of a lot of artists, first of all, it seems like a hell of a lot of them died from tuberculosis. There was drug use as well, which probably didn't help. And, you know, just sort of living in relative poverty, I think, also probably didn't help for some people.
Yes.
But yeah, the idea of just being so consumed by one's work, which was the thing that you was sort of pulling you away, that you negated to take care of yourself, really connect with your family. Yeah, it's very interesting that the demon lover it's not as simple as a mere sexual thing, but something that tempts you away from what is good, as it were. And when I say good, what is considered to be important.
Yeah, wholesome and healthy.
Yeah.
And in that respect, it's very reflective of any bad relationship that isolates you.
Yeah.
Definitely. Okay, an early example of the demon lover mythos is actually Persephone and Hades. And the, you know, the one we're fed is the one where Hades sees Persephone picking wildflowers and desires her. So he hitches up his chariot and breaks through the earth and abducts her.
Yeah.
And it's very rape heavy.
Yeah.
Etc. And you have the grieving Demeter, who is obviously trying to get her
daughter back.
Get her daughter back, which is where we get wind from, etc., etc. Except the original myth was not that. In the original myth, Persephone was bored, and yes, she was the daughter of the goddess of growing things, but she was actually kind of, I want something for myself.
Mm.
And she found a door into hell, went down, and was like, I kind of like this. And she went up to Hades and said, I'm going to live here now. And Hades was a bit taken aback and sort of said, well, okay, I guess. And she's like, I like the look of you too. You're going to be my husband. And again, Hades was like, okay, well, I guess who am I to argue with you? Demeter did have the whole hissy fit still, but Persephone had very much taken her agency and her sexual agency into her own hands.
Yeah.
And decided to carve out a place for herself. It's just that then when you had the shift from the more matriarchal pre-Greek religion to the more patriarchal sky god type Greek religions,
yeah,
they changed the mythology, because they can't have a mythos where you've got a young girl basically saying, I'm going to be the queen of hell. I've decided, and you shall be my husband.
Yeah.
So it is a demon lover mythos, but it's very different in the sense of Persephone goes out and seeks her demon lover. She goes out and looks for the gratification she wants.
Yeah. It is also interesting that they basically, you know, she goes out and does it, and it's made into a demon lover in so much as the sort of the parameters shifted around the story, in so much that what was considered wholesome, what was considered good in a young woman finding and carving her own place, is now been changed, and what is considered wholesome is a woman, you know, a woman's place beside her mother as part of, you know, that side of things, and not and being an object, as it were.
Yeah, definitely. And it was then feeding into the whole the thing where, you know, we went through, obviously, if you look at the Spartan women had very active roles in politics and religion. They trained with the men even if they didn't go into war, and they were physically very, very fit. The idea was obviously that if you were physically fit, then you would give birth to healthy children.
Yeah.
And that there's actually quite a lot of merit to that idea. And then if you compare it to the Greeks, who were starting to shut their women up in houses and not letting them go out and keeping their skin fairly pale by keeping them indoors all the time.
Yeah.
You can actually see through from the mythology that the changing attitudes there. Mm. As you say, it's the idea of what was wholesome.
Yeah.
Women were not supposed to want or enjoy sex. They were supposed to want children, and sex was the hurdle they had to kind of get over.
Yeah.
Therefore, you had to have a swooning, possibly crying Persephone being abducted in order for it to be considered a suitable sort of marriage story, I guess.
And it is, it's always funny to me, these kinds of things, because it shows this whole side of kind of Greek culture on the male side, which is that the weird respect, well, the respect they had for their own mothers, because, you know, they would be close to their parents, to their mothers when they were little, because the mother was kind of like the centre of their whole world, because that was the role of the mother, to be the centre of the whole world. So they had this sort of respect for their mothers, but they didn't necessarily have respect for the other women. So no. Demeter gets respect as a mother, as long as she's in the role of mother. Persephone only gets respected once she's in the role of wife, but she's still lesser. But the thing that I really like is that it's like, well, women are not supposed to enjoy sex, being this massive cover-up of the fact that actually these men were clearly not very good at it.
Yeah, by and large. On the other hand, I mean, it all gets very confused. I mean, we obviously don't go so in-depth in Greek mythology that we talk about the fact that the Greek myths stretch across hundreds of years. So yes. Obviously you can't look at Greek myth and say, yes, this represents 100 years. It's not, it's centuries and centuries and centuries. And obviously the myths get recycled and reused, etc., etc.
Yeah.
Which is why when you get to the point where it was considered much more acceptable for men to be having sex with each other and only really having sex with women in order to produce children.
Yeah.
And presumably the women were doing the same thing. Except we don't talk about them because, according to Greek philosophers, women are sort of lesser beings than horses and dogs. So, yeah, it's that there's no body of myth there that's absolutely representative.
Yeah. And, yeah, unfortunately, again, also remember, every time you read a myth, consider how many times it's been translated.
Yeah. These are living stories. It's the same with fairy tales. And there's a lot of demon lover type stuff that comes into fairy tales. I mean, Rotcatchen or Little Red Riding Hood, for example.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they change every time. And they have to be allowed to continue to change. Nobody can ever give you the absolute origin story of Snow White, for example.
No. Absolutely.
Okay, so I've made a note here that the sort of the whole demon lover mythos of Western minds was a sort of the original baby It's Cold Outside of the latter centuries, which, okay, you know what, I really like that song, and I get that it's a very tongue-in-cheek kind of, this is not about rape culture, this is kind of like, no, we're both down for this, but I have to pretend, I have to show maidenly reluctance. I'm glad things are not that way anymore.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, people who take it out of context and get really, really upset every Christmas when it's played, I'm just like, for God's sake, get a life. Or at least crack a book or something, you know?
The thing is, like, I can understand, and it is, it's about context. Context does make a massive amount of difference.
Yes.
And actually, it's important to recognise the demon lover aspect there, the which is almost like he, yeah, the baby It's Cold Outside, he is sort of being that demon lover, as it were. But it's all born from a very Victorian mindset, which sort of is carried on. But in understanding the context of that song isn't just important in terms of understanding the song, it's actually really important in terms of understanding people and fiction in general, and actually why some people might seem to enjoy certain things. Like, for example, a lot of people sort of complain about people who really enjoy, like, the villain characters.
Yeah.
And they're like, why? Or why, yeah, why do you have these fantasies about these people who are really bad people? And I think for a lot of people, you know, for a lot of viewers, for a lot of fans, they'll look at these people and say, oh God, yeah, I'm really attracted to this person. But they wouldn't necessarily want to date them if they were a real person. The whole point is that they're fictional. It's all fictional. And yeah. That mindset, which is what was discussed in this post, and which actually kind of really struck me in a lot of ways, is the hang-on from sort of the Victorian mentality, which is continued on, of a woman is not supposed to want to have sex. And yet, for a large amount of us, we do. And so you get these girls and boys who are raised being told to want sex is bad. You should not have these desires. And in fact, to have these desires makes you base or ugly. And so what happens is that women who are raised with this, even subconsciously, get put into this situation whereby they are not allowed to express these desires, even though they have them. Which means that when it comes to the fantasy of imagining, right, I want to have sex, or I want to imagine, or I want to be romanced, I want there to be this kind of illicit thing, something, and I say illicit because that's how they understand it, within those fantasies, they have to have a character who understands what they want. And even though they object, because they're supposed to object, the character still gives them what they want.
Yeah.
Now that's very important, because if we understand this, we can also understand how some people end up in really bad relationships, and why, and how we can actually prevent it. But also, it's important to understand that the whole fantasizing thing for some people is actually normal and healthy, and isn't indicative of them being some sort of terrible human being.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing that people sometimes don't get. And obviously the demon lover thing can cross into sort of rape fantasy territory.
Yeah.
But that's not really what it's about. And honestly, that's not really what rape fantasy is about. It's about abdicating responsibility for what's about to happen.
Yeah.
So that it's done to you, therefore you've never really done anything wrong.
Yeah.
And yet you can still have the fun, as it were.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. That's perfectly normal. Or at least it's perfectly normal when... Even up until I was at, I don't know, university, there was still this mindset of you're not really supposed to want to, or rather maybe with one or maybe two people kind of thing.
Yeah.
But you mustn't be frigid, but you mustn't be too loose either. And it's just, it's ridiculous. And hopefully that attitude is changing, but I still encounter it now. And we'll go back and we'll talk about the Victorians probably in a moment and the Gothic. But I just... think that they're, you know, I was talking about my little graph earlier about, you know, you have your one line of demon lover mythos evolution and your one line of what's going on in the world kind of thing. It's really noticeable that the people of my generation are writing a lot of paranormal romance.
Yeah.
Particularly featuring alpha male types, which, you know, it's really boring as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, the vampire, the shapeshifter kind of thing, the overpowering alpha male who knows exactly what she wants kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I get why people criticise those, but at the same time, the people who are criticising them are kind of missing the point of why they've come about, and they're not challenging the original narrative that's given way to this.
Yeah. And I think, for me, something that I got increasingly upset and angry about was that in trying to find fiction, LGBT fiction, what I come across more often than not, is this very toxic atmosphere in terms of how the stories are written. I say toxic in that what happens is, it is, and I'm sorry to say, it's quite rapey, particularly for sort of things that you get in, well, for instance, Mordao Zushi, which is the original book of The Untamed, the Chinese drama. It's a homosexual fantasy book, and the story is great. And then when the two main characters get together, there are several sex scenes, And they're actually really uncomfortable. Incredibly uncomfortable. Like, I had to skip them because they are purposefully written in a very, very rapey way.
Yeah.
And I hated it. I really hated it. And yet, at the same time, I remind myself of the fact that where is this story coming from? You know, a culture which actually wanted to make the story into a series, but they couldn't actually have it being openly homosexual because that would go against their censorship laws.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't surprise me because that whole kind of thing of, right, it's happening to them. Therefore, there's no responsibility. Therefore, they say no because they're supposed to say no, but actually they are getting what they want. It makes total sense that it has come out of that. Just as it makes total sense that among very sort of repressed areas, you get even more of that content. And so I'm not actually surprised that so much of LGBT fiction is full of this very, very, very graphic kind of stuff. And it doesn't really surprise me as well that it actually compares to sort of the Victorian Gothic fantasy, which is what we'll get into in a second, in so much as there's still this perception of LGBT content being overly sexualized.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, there'd be, it's the whole defined by the sexual aspect of it rather than...
Yeah, exactly.
The fact that it's different perspective. Yeah.
And I think that a part of that is the same thing, that, you know, the same reason why a lot of sort of the Gothic things were considered to be over-sexualized, in that it is playing on that fantasy because as a result of repression, ultimately. And as we now move into a society which is a little bit more accepting and open towards LGBT individuals... in some areas, in some parts. I'm not going to go into that, it's depressing. But we're starting to move away from the need to have those quite violent fantasies, which are a result of this massive repression of the ability to feel and to actually come out and be open about your feelings and to not feel guilty about them.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, let's have a quick look at the Gothic.
Yay!
As Madeline says, kind of has a lot of sexual content. It's an interesting one, really, because you think of the Gothic as being kind of like the antithesis of sort of sexual awareness, but a lot of it is to do with sexual awakening.
Yes.
And sometimes, you know, if you have something Gothic where the ending is tends to be more bitter than sweet, then usually that's someone's rejected that part of themselves. So... if you're looking at, say, Rebecca, for example, Rebecca, I still maintain, is told from the perspective of a self-hating woman, a misogynist woman, who has real difficulty with her own sexuality.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I would not say Rebecca has a happy ending at all. I mean, she's in hiding in a largely sexist relationship with a man who, yes, she's got him, but does she really want him?
Yeah.
And then you take things like Jane Eyre, which again is sort of a bit gothic-y, and it has a happy ending, definitely. And it has a happy ending, I think, because Jane approaches sex, ultimately, marriage being the big euphemism for sex here, and it's made very, very clear that obviously they do have sex because she has children. You have to learn to read 19th century literature for the sexual content, but it is there. There's lots of it, I promise. And it is just a case of she approaches it on her terms.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, you have Rebecca, which is based on Jane Eyre, showing the bitter ending of a Gothic whereby someone has rejected their sexuality. And then Jane Eyre, which is kind of like, I've embraced it, but only under my terms, my consent.
Yeah, absolutely. And then there's Dracula, which, yeah. which, you know, I always just feel sorry for Lucy as a character.
Lucy gets punished for wanting what effectively translates to sexual agency.
Yeah.
And it doesn't even feel like Bram Stoker's saying that Lucy's in the wrong. It more feels like he's saying, yeah, this is the society we live in right now, which, you know, would have been true.
Yeah. And there's also a sense that it's funny that Lucy is the one who kind of falls in, you know, becomes this victim. Because she's also basically the one who's being wooed by all these men. I mean, it starts with her stories that she gets proposed to 3 times.
Yeah.
And ultimately obviously chooses one person, but everyone else stays good friends because they love her so much.
She's really innocent, that's the thing. I mean, yes, she's a little bit of a coquette, but at the same time, she's actually really innocent.
Yeah. She's...
And then she never obviously marries anyone, so...
Yeah, and it is almost like this idea that the redeeming part about her is that she's almost childlike.
Yes.
Which is the kind of the narrative there. It's like the redeeming part is, oh, well, we can forgive you because you're just so sweet. You're such a lovely girl. But she's never allowed to actually become married because if there was sexual agency involved, where, you know, she's looking at these 3 men, she's thinking, who do I actually desire? Not just who do I love in a very pure way. She would go from being this lovely figure to a deviant figure, which is what she becomes, a deviant figure, obviously against her will. And yet there's this idea that she's kind of been seduced away.
Yeah, there's something within her that wanted this, and therefore she was kind of ripe fruit.
Yeah.
Dracula's a really interesting one, because if we're looking at folklore vampires are really gross.
Yeah.
Folklore vampires are not drinking blood, they're drinking feces and urine and turning up and drinking your life energy at night. And they're just hanging around and generally being nuisances. They're not great.
Sorry, but, I love that description. Just being a general nuisance.
It's kind of like it hangs around outside the house, and if you happen to have a newborn baby, there's a good chance it'll cause it to die in its crib, kind of thing. It's someone. Often there's nothing to do with biting involved. It's somebody who did not receive the right funeral rites, or it's somebody who died with malice in their hearts.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of crossover between the traditional sort of malevolent ghost, and then you get Dracula, and he's still not super sexy at this point in time, but at the same time, he's definitely got more of an allure. There's definitely a sexual component that Bram Stoker's put in. If we go from Dracula to the silent film era, whereby obviously you occasionally you had black and white footage and everything was really overacted so that the audience could see facial expressions, etc. And then you'd have some piano playing. And then every so often the words for the dialogue would pop up on the screen. It's really interesting to watch the progression, because you start off with things like Nosferatu, where the vampire is really repulsive, and there's a very sort of rapey feel to it.
Yeah.
The idea of this repulsive creature leaning over a beautiful sleeping woman.
Yeah,
and then you get onto the more debonair vampires, whereby suddenly the woman is being... It's very noticeable that her artistically arranged nightgown is exposing her shoulders, which is very risky.
Yeah. But it's also... I should point out, Nosferatu is where we get the whole sort of becoming ash in sunlight.
Yes.
That was never original Dracula.
No.
He isn't like sunlight. He's a creature of the night, but it doesn't kill him.
He's weaker in sunlight, but yeah, it doesn't burn him alive.
No, and so I think that, yeah, with the whole sort of Nosferatu thing, is that there's an element as well of like, this is 100% a creature of the night. In daylight, it will not survive. It does not survive scrutiny.
That's also, those early vampire films is also kind of where we got the biting on the neck thing. And it was a very clear sexual simulation.
Yeah.
Obviously, the fangs being inserted into the neck, which was the neck and shoulders being sort of the expanse of flesh you could reasonably show on screen at that time.
And then you could see a heaving bosom.
Yes. So this is all very sort of like, we're making you think of sex. We're making you think of sex right now. And it's something that has continued all the way up through every permutation of vampire film since. Because there's nothing like a classic, apparently.
Absolutely. And the thing that always really interested me is that in the original Dracula, he has some sort of magnetism towards women. But towards men, they're all like, well, he's super ugly.
Some of them, it literally changes the screen, doesn't it? And you see from the male perspective, and he is actually physically repulsive.
Yeah, and the thing that really amuses me is that obviously Dracula is, you know, It's written from different from their perspectives, or rather, you know, it's their accounts, which means that they're unreliable narrators. So
yes.
It's quite like the idea that actually he's an attractive guy, and they're all just like, well, he was really ugly. Yeah, didn't ever.
Oh, he was repulsive. He's like, did you like him? No, I didn't like him. I've never seen an uglier man.
Yeah, he's all these smarmy looks, and that's just they're like. I think, you know, there is this idea that maybe he was actually an attractive person. He was just attractive in a way that would have been considered foreign, perhaps.
Yes. Which begs the question as to sort of what Renfield's orientation was, really, doesn't it?
Yes.
But anyway.
Dracula also, I should really add, is that you do definitely get the demon lover in terms of the sort of the homosexual side, because Jonathan Harker... The whole sort of, he's mine, says Dracula, with his arms around Jonathan Harker.
We never see Dracula actually feed on Jonathan, and Jonathan's very sketchy on those details. He talks about the mother and the two sisters who do feed on him, because apparently that's acceptable, and quite clearly there's a sexual component there, because he talks about desiring their kisses kind of thing, being compelled by them.
Yeah, there's this sense of more equality between Dracula and Jonathan Harker, particularly to begin with. Dracula actually enjoys talking to him. Dracula is weirdly protective of him. I mean, if he was fine with just kind of, you know, just saying, we need him for now, he could have just said... Stop, we need him for now, not he's mine. That's very possessive.
Yeah, there's definitely, I think, an element there. And this is something that vampire writers have definitely picked up on. Obviously, Anne Rice is the classic example, the homoeroticism. Yeah. And it is no big leap to go from the silent films with the sexual simulation of fangs inserted into the neck to, oh, well, if you're doing that male on male, then... What are we really saying here, guys? Because now we're thinking of sex and it's two guys and, oh god, we don't know what to do with this kind of thing.
We made it gay!
Damn, gay vampires! And Anne Rice just rolls into it with, yeah, they are. They're kind of like, you know, at that point it's not about procreation, so why wouldn't they? You're going to live forever, wouldn't you try everything on the menu?
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Which makes sense to me. So, it is really, really interesting. And obviously, we mentioned incubi and succubi as well, the female version. And it's just a case of, they feed on your life energy through having sex with you while you're asleep. Yeah. That is a very classic demon lover type scenario, obviously.
Yeah.
Before we go, well, or rather, actually, let's get on to... I just want to do a little aside on Earl Conig and Goblin King.
Yes.
Because what's really... I mean, this is what largely that Tumblr post was about, but because obviously it was talking about Labyrinth. But Labyrinth is a retelling of the Earl Conig myth. The story of the Earl Conig is that he's very strange-looking, even ugly, and he steals away children or steals away young women. Obviously, that's literally what happens in Labyrinth. He steals away the baby at Sarah's behest. And I find it really interesting because this is kind of like the sexual fantasy demon lover type aspect for a much younger section. So this isn't somebody who's been repressing their sexuality for a while. This is someone who's coming into their sexuality. Yeah. And it's the idea that you are a blossoming young thing and you might get stolen away by the Goblin King.
It interests me because I think that there's this massive kind of taboo around talking about children being sexually curious.
Yes, which obviously they absolutely are, and it's perfectly normal.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that anyone's allowed to just prey on them, obviously.
No, absolutely not. But the whole point also is that I think there's this massive taboo about the fact that when, particularly for... young girls, but also I think for queer individuals, there is this, you know, that they tend to kind of crush on people who are much older than them. I know as a young girl, I wasn't looking at the kind of the guys who are my age and being like, I'm interested in you. I was looking at guys who are significantly older than me, and women.
Well, yeah, actually. In hindsight, yeah, me too. And the thing was, if, particularly with the boys, it was kind of like, why would you, a 14-year-old girl, be attracted to a 14-year-old boy? Have you seen 14-year-old boys? kind of thing. And then you get to 17, it's like, 17-year-old boys, ew!
Yeah.
With a lot of them. And it's not necessarily that you want someone who is in their late 20s or their early 30s. It's just a case of, you're going to... These hormones and feelings have to go somewhere. You have to focus them in some direction. And it's safe to pick an object that's unattainable or should be unattainable.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I think it's also... And this is why I always laugh whenever they've got, like, sort of high school shows where it's just they're like, oh, and they're all attracted to one another. I'm like, I'm not surprised. They're all played by, like, 20-something-year-olds.
Yeah. I think this is a thing that people have a real difficulty with when it comes to looking at sort of teenage sexual attraction. Yeah. And that is the fact that that basically they're not necessarily thinking about going into actually having sex. They're still dealing with this influx of chemicals. Yeah. They're still looking at the, oh my god, have we got to the first kiss stage kind of thing? Or the, oh god, I can't be seen holding someone's hand in public. This is too embarrassing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Stage. I mean, you're caught between the, oh, boys is really, really gross, and the, oh, why do I feel like this kind of thing? Why do I want to knock him down and fall on top of him? Or her. Sometimes it's her.
But yeah, absolutely. And I think that it's kind of normal as well that, of course, they sort of fantasize about people who are older than them, but they fantasize about, you know, like posters of bands and stuff like that. You sort of fall in love with these faraway people, these fantasies, who are not actionable, as it were. It's very safe.
And therefore, they're
it's
safe.
It's a very safe kind of sort of fantasy. And the Goblin King works in the same way, in that he is a fantasy. And one of the big sort of moments for Sarah, isn't it?
Yeah.
At the end, is basically saying, you have no power over me. And it's this kind of... I've always found that very interesting, and there's lots of ways that it could be interpreted, but the reason I found that sort of interesting was Sarah actually falling so deep into her own fantasies that they had become a nightmare. And it was basically actually her being able to turn around and say, actually, you can't hurt me. I am in control here. Everything here is actually under my domain. This is my kingdom. I am safe here, even from you.
And it's beautifully juxtaposed to the ballroom scene whereby she's under the influence of that bespelled peach. Whereby she feels like a child playing dress up at a very grown up ball, and everything about that ball is sort of opulent, and it's about wearing a mask, literally wearing a mask, but also wearing a mask so that someone doesn't really see you properly. Yeah. It's very noticeable she's not wearing one. She is in a room where the conversation is literally sex, and there's a hint that she might be ready for it but isn't quite there under her own steam. Yeah. It's noticeable she breaks out of that, and then at the end, with that juxtaposed scene where she says, you have no power over me, she is basically saying, I'm in control of all of this. I don't need to abdicate responsibility for my own sexual agency.
Yeah.
And that is part of what becoming an adult is about, is accepting that side of yourself.
Yeah. So the demon lover actually is very important in actually teenage fiction. And particularly how it's approached is actually a very good way of helping people kind of understand or even deal with their own sort of budding sexuality. Or, you know, and again, when we say sexuality, it doesn't necessarily mean the act of sex or the wanting of sex, but also, you know, a lot of the other things that come with it. It's like maturity. Relationships, romance, all of these kinds of things, and whether you want it or not.
Yeah, a sense of your own power and your own value as well is a really important component. Yeah. So, yeah, demon lover stories, I mean, they're largely intended to help us live out a sexual fantasy without the consequences that go with that, with genuinely experimenting. Yeah. And doing so, like all fantasies to some extent, helps us I suppose it helps us choose which parts of the conditioning we want to keep and which parts we want to get rid of, or it should do at its most ideal.
Yeah. Now, the reason actually why these things need to be acknowledged is that obviously in times when the demon lover also becomes much more prevalent, and again, I emphasize that the demon lover is something that is present pretty much everywhere, because actually it's a part of growing up. And should be a part of that journey. When it becomes very, very prevalent, that tends to mean that actually something needs to be done, because it also means that there are people who are under threat of actually falling too much into the fantasy, which actually results in them being taken advantage of by bad, bad people.
Yeah, yeah, potentially. I think that was part of the Tumblr post, was that Jared could be perceived as a sexual predator, and it's like, yeah, on a shallow reading you could absolutely perceive it that way.
Absolutely.
But since he's actually the possession of Sarah's own fantasy, her own mind, he's not. It's kind of flirting with the idea of, do I want this or don't I? And in the end, the choice is hers. In the end, she is the thing he is most afraid of.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, the fact of the matter is that I think what happens is that a lot of people are against the demon lover because they think that it encourages, that it romanticizes this idea. And that's where you start to get this line being drawn, because the demon lover is meant to be a fantasy. He's not necessarily meant to romanticize that kind of behavior, but sometimes he does, especially when people create characters based on the demon lover without actually understanding what it is. Now, Labyrinth, I think that they knew exactly what they were writing about and exactly what he is and what he represents. But I think that there have been a lot of offcuts based on just, oh, well, that's popular, without actually understanding why it's popular, why it's needed, and in doing so, actually creating some unhealthy expectations about real life relationships.
Yeah, it's like, okay, I'm going to say Twilight. Twilight kind of gets it right towards the end of the series, but it has to go through a lot of, it's almost crash testing the entire fantasy all the way through. Yeah. And the problem is, I'm not sure all of that crash testing is intentional. I think some of it is just kind of, I want to tell this wish fulfillment fantasy story, which is absolutely fine. But of course, the target audience it went to and then got taken on by was the target audience that absolutely needs that archetype, but at the same time also needs to be able to see that archetype run its course. And it kind of doesn't really run its course until the final book. Yeah. By which point everybody's thinking, this is insane. This is a codependent relationship. This isn't right. And also there's lots of other icky stuff in there as well. But again, you know, there's nothing wrong with someone writing something that's basically wish fulfillment fantasy. No. And sort of Twilight suffers from its own success a little bit there. Yeah. Because I think I've seen way, way worse examples in much less popular books.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I really have as well. And I'm not going to sort of point fingers here, but I do tend to find that when straight cis male writers are writing about the demon lover kind of fantasy, that's when they tend to misunderstand.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I suppose we're running to the end of our episode, but let's finish up with some of our favourite demon lover myths and tales.
Well, I know I've mentioned her already, but I always liked the Lenenshi from mythology, not least because there's something very mournful about her as a figure as well. In that if you look at her, it doesn't feel so much like she's preying on them. It feels like she actually sort of loves them. And she's mournful as well, that she's just as in love with them, and that their love burns bright and hot, and kind of what she represents in terms of that sort of that artistic fervour. I've just always found it very, very interesting how she can be used in sort of folklore and myth and story.
Yeah, definitely. And the other thing interesting about the Lenshe is the fact that it's not necessarily gender specific either. As in, it's normally a female, but it's also a case of she's not necessarily picky. She just cares that you're an artist or a musician, which is always an interesting sidebar. Yeah.
What about you?
I obviously am a big fan of Labyrinth. It's one of my favourite films. But I've always liked the Elconic myth. Even its darker permutations have got something that grabs me. An offshoot of the whole Elconic type thing is obviously the Goblin Market, which I've got a bit of a fascination for. And I think we've talked about Christina Rossetti's poem a lot, and you know what it's based on. But it's a very, very sexual poem. It's the idea of seeing these strange creatures in a weirdly sexual light while you're sort of glutting yourself on sweet fruit, which again is a very sexual
image.
So I mean, that's always I don't know. There's a hint of horror, but a lot of fascination in that one. For me. I like the original Persephone and Hades as well, obviously.
Yeah, I do like the Goblin Market, particularly because it just feels like Rossetti is throwing so much shade. Like this whole sort of like in this era where they were all talking about how women were like little fairies, demure, a bit coquettish, but you know, ultimately, sometimes seen, never heard, you know, kind of thing. Yeah. And she's like, well, men are like goblins.
And I think that there is a subtext of, and you expect us to sleep with you. That's as much effort as you guys put in, and somehow we're expected to want you. We're supposed to eat your wares.
Oh, good old Rossetti. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week, however. And Jules, I believe that you've got one for us.
Yes, I've just recently finished a book called The Fairy Hounds of York by Arden Powell. It's a really interesting and slightly Bronte-esque tale. Basically, the main character wakes up at the beginning of the book inside a fairy ring on the North Yorkshire moors, and which is always a good start. He is helped out of the fairy ring by a man who happened to be passing. I mean, what are the odds, because the North Yorkshire moors are huge. This man is half Romany, and the two end up going on a journey to try and get the main character's fairy enchantment reversed. And as you go on, you find out more and more about the man who rescued him as well. It's a male-male romance. It's quite sweet and very... The atmosphere is very sort of turgid and heavy, and again, you've got that lowering landscape that you find in things like Wuthering Heights. And my theory is that Arden Powell read Wuthering Heights and went, I'm going to get rid of Cathy and I'm just going to have a nicer Heathcliff and a nicer Linton, and then I'm going to have them together. I've decided I ship these two because that is what those two characters are like. And I'm like, I feel like I should be annoyed that you've done this, and yet it kind of really works, so I'm on board. It does have, I mean, there are a few points, it's not a retelling or anything, but it has a few points of commonality with Wuthering Heights and with other sort of Bronte-esque type stuff, and it's got a very bittersweet ending, but I do recommend it. And it's obviously the nastiest sort of fae. We're not talking sort of pretty little pixies sitting in bluebells or anything. No. These are hungry beings who prey on humans.
Excellent. Well, you know I like the sound of that. On that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening. Do leave us a comment telling us who your favourite demon lover is, whether you agree with us, whether you disagree with us, or just in general, whether you have anything to say at all on the subject. We'd love to hear from you. Remember, you can get in touch with us on Facebook and on Twitter. We are also now on Spotify, so do find us there as well. For now, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.